They went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took with him Peter and James and John and began to be distressed and agitated. And he said to them, "I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and keep awake." And going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. He said, "Abba, Father, for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I want, but what you want." He came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep awake 1 hour? Keep awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And once more he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to say to him. He came a third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Enough! The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand."
I invite you to take your sermon notes and study outline out of your worship folder. Probably every one of us listening today has been confronted with something in our lives that has pushed us to make decisions, have pushed us to act, and yet we're pushed to act in ways that we wished we didn't have to act, and yet something larger, something bigger than life mandates it must be so. Last Monday morning about 5:30 a.m., I was driving my daughter to the airport for her return trip to Washington, D.C., where she has resided for the last 7 years and works in the political arena. The morning was quiet and the highway was, for the most part, undisturbed by the breaking of the day. I began to talk about preparation for this sermon. I rehearsed for her the story of Jesus in that olive grove garden that the choir and the orchestra and the dramatist have just helped us hear again. Quite frankly, you should know as a pastor mother, I was grateful for another opportunity to preach to my child. She was a captive audience, and she knew it. Any of you parents who long for your children to know and to be strong in the spiritual foundation in which you have raised them in know what I'm talking about. Anyway, I told her I had read the Passion narrative many times. I had preached this particular pericope a couple of times, but for the first time, I found myself, as far as I could remember, asking questions about why the garden story followed that Last Supper the way that it did. I told her for the first time I found myself asking why Jesus took James and John and Peter to the garden with him knowing that they would betray him in that garden. I explained that up until this preparation, my focus had always been on James and John and Peter and their inability to meet Jesus, to be with Jesus, to support him in that critical hour of need. And always my focus had been on the intense violence that occurred in the garden, the way in which Jesus was arrested. And we didn't read that this morning. It is a part of the garden story, but we didn't read where Jesus will be arrested and all the violence that takes place. We didn't read where Judas finally blatantly betrays him. But I told her this time it was different. I found myself with a need to more fully understand the action of Jesus. I found myself wanting Jesus and wanting God and wanting an answer to Jesus' question, "Lord, what do you want?" I no longer thought it was just for Jesus to die, and I can remember for years, especially in my early years, as I started my own faith journey and began to study Scripture for myself, even when I started seminary, for so many years, my theology was that what God really wanted to happen in that garden was, or what God really wanted to happen was for Jesus to die. I no longer think that's the reason for it. I think if we'll get to that later on, what I really think at this point. And maybe you're somebody who has that same belief, that that's exactly what you believe God wanted to happen, was for Jesus to die. I told her that perhaps teaching Disciple 5, Jesus in the Gospels, with Pastor Nancy over this last year had helped me come to this different view. I don't want you to misunderstand me this morning. In the past, I had looked at Jesus, the intensity of his prayers, his cry that if it were possible to have the hour pass before him. I had always paid attention to his surrender. I recall now the thoughtful, pregnant silence in my little small car that had all dominion over the highway that morning. I recall Simone's tender and yet fully convicted voice as she shared her wisdom-filled thoughts. She said, "Mom, you know that place where we find the courage to do things we thought we could never do, and we do them because something more powerful inside of us knows that real life, that true life, comes from that. And even if you have to die for that life to happen or for that life to be realized, I suppose you'd say, well, Mom, especially you'd say, it's worth it." She went on, she said, "It makes me think, as this person in the political arena, it makes me think about the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated and what Jackie Onassis Kennedy did in that hour." She went on to describe the story, and I want to ask you this morning, do you remember the day President Kennedy was assassinated? Unlike our story today, it's not the 11 o'clock hour. And unlike in our story today, with its darkness of the garden, untainted by streetlights or occasional headlights, November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas was a clear blue sky day. The sun was shining and the air was crisp, and whoever it was that had the authority over the motorcade that day had made the decision to put the top down, and the crowds were excited and children were playing and music and cheers filled the crisp and inviting air. And then suddenly, in an instant, all of that is shattered as the distinctive, deafening, piercing, unmistakable shot, or maybe shots, disarms the hope and pleasure of the crowd. Picture it. President Kennedy's body is slumped over Mrs. Kennedy's lap, and the uncontrolled blood, boldly and without resignation, stains that beautiful suit, that beautiful pink suit she wore that day. Perhaps you recall the story from history. Maybe you were close by on that day. Maybe you have studied it in school. But irregardless of how you know the story, when historians and journalists would write about his assassination, they would recall that after he had been pronounced dead, Jacqueline Onassis Kennedy, in all her gracefulness, would choose not to retreat from the crowd. She would choose not to run from the evil. She would choose not to change the blood-stained suit. She would choose to face the evil that the world had assaulted her with and had assaulted others with. She would choose to go on with life. In our text today, Jesus in the garden preparing to face what is on some level the end of life demonstrates for us what it means to face evil, both the evil that we do and the evil that we encounter in the world. And it comes in many names: hatred, betrayal, denial, paralyzing fear. Jesus shows us that in the face of intense suffering and prolonged pain, there is a way out, that agony is not defeat, that the journey to the cross is not the place where we focus on the violence, but we look at what God intended for us to learn about the ways that you challenge evil. In that 11 o'clock hour in the garden that night, Jesus shows us God's answer to his cry. If it's possible, let this hour pass, but not what I want. What do you want, Lord? God wants Jesus to show us those who follow him. He wants us to show those who have been called by him, those who call ourselves the disciples, to extend his mission, that in the midst of evil, in the midst of unparalleled, blatant betrayal, Jesus shows us we must choose the way of life. That way of life comes clearer to us as we pray. Jesus shows us when we don't know what to do, we must pray. The kind of prayer I'm talking about that goes deeper than words, the kind of prayer that throws all of yourself on God, the kind of prayer that receives and gives. And it makes me recall a story of a woman in one of my Al-Anon recovery books. She described being married to her husband who drank just a little bit in the beginning of their 20-plus year marriage and then how it escalated. She talked about how she had found Al-Anon and later on he had discovered Alcoholic Anonymous and they both began to change. And she described that one night after he had been sober for several months, he was getting ready for his late shift as a maintenance person at the school. And she said she could feel that in the air there was something not right, kind of like we can feel in the air as we came into the sanctuary this morning. We could feel that the air was stirring and something was going on. And perhaps something was not quite right. She said that old feelings of anxiousness and fear began to rise up in her. She agonized about what to do. And then she remembered that the 12 steps had taught her that she was powerless over her husband's drinking, that she could not control him or his drinking, that she could not fix whatever was not good for him. It had also taught her that through prayer and meditation, she could improve her conscious contact with God and that she could pray for the knowledge of God's will and that God's will and the power of God would help her carry it out. After he left for work, she then decided that's exactly what she would do. She fell down on her knees at the side of her bed and she began to pray. And she prayed and as she describes the story, she says, sometimes the words didn't make sense. It was just moaning and crying and just a constant asking for God's will and looking for direction. And she said it went on like that for many hours till about 5 o'clock. And suddenly she felt a release, she felt a surrender and she fell into bed. She recalls being awakened by her husband entering the bedroom. She could tell that he had not been drinking. She asked how his night had been, and he began to tell her that the strangest thing had happened shortly after she got to work. He got to work. He said he somehow had knocked over a can of toxic solvent material, and somehow it had started a fire. And for most of the night, he found himself with the fire engines and fire trucks and writing reports and cleaning up a room. And he said it was about 5 o'clock when he finally settled and at 6 o'clock it was time to go home. Now, I don't want to suggest this morning that it was God that caused that accident as his wife prayed, but I do believe that her prayers made a difference, and I do believe that God used that accident for the good of that family. Paul, writing in the book of Romans, had this to say about prayer. He said, meanwhile, the moment we get tired in the waiting, God's Spirit is right alongside, helping us along. If we don't know how or what to pray, it doesn't matter. He does our praying in and for us, making prayer out of our wordless sighs, our aching groans. He knows us far better than we know ourselves, knows our pregnant condition, and keeps us present before God. That's why we can be so sure that every detail in our lives of love for God is worked into something good. Jesus showed us in the garden in that 11 o'clock hour the way through evil was in the power to pray, and the way to face that evil was the power to pray. You know, too often in big as well as in small decisions, we decide what to do and then we ask God to tag along. Somebody said we reduce God to an afterthought. In the study guide for next week, you'll notice on the back side of the sermon outline, you'll find where I have created several opportunities for you to strengthen your prayer life, for you to improve your conscious contact with God, for you to invite God to be more than just a tag-along God. I pray you'll take advantage of that. But you know, even when we know what we should do, we don't always do it. And even when we've prayed, still there's something that distracts us, something that gets in the way. We still find ourselves, our mere selves, caught. We call that the human condition. And Jesus showed us what to do with that too. When Jesus found the disciples sleeping the second time he went away to pray, he admonished them, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Our humanness makes us weak. And I know, and Jesus knew, it's hard being human. And in the garden in that 11 o'clock hour, in verse 34, he shows us that he really knows what's it about. Jesus says, "I feel like I am in a sinkhole of dreadful agony." Webster's Encyclopedia Dictionary defines agony as an extreme and generally prolonged pain, intense suffering. Some other translations of this passage describe Jesus feeling horror-stricken or desperately depressed or overtaken with sudden fear. He said his soul was sorrowful to the point of death. You see, the problem is that as human beings in our human condition, we want to manage and control the world so that no suffering can occur and no evil can be present. And even though we know this is impossible, when we try to control the world, we can bring about as much evil as profound as any we seek to avoid. Such efforts to master evil stem from goodwill and a sense of responsibility on our part. But when the truth is discovered that we cannot prevent or escape evil, we retreat into denial. We cooperate with evil. Jesus showed us that denying our human condition, our feelings, our distresses, the evils of this world is not the way to life. He showed us to be in agony is not defeat. We must not deny evil in this way. Now, there's lots of ways to be in denial. Sometimes it's in an escapist mentality, where we seek only our own pleasure and ignore the rest of the world. Reverend Clayton Smith, our executive pastor of Stewardship and Worship, just implemented several small pilot groups which utilize a program ministry called Crown Ministries, and it teaches biblical principles for managing our personal finances. The ministry was started many years ago by Larry Burkett. And in writing about his start of this ministry and his own movement into learning about what it means to surrender totally to God, everything, Mr. Burkett writes in his pursuit of economic security, he found that it robbed him of time with family and with God. He said one morning he came home from work, crawled into bed about 2 a.m., and because it was his habit to keep on the side of his bed a Bible, he decided to open the Bible. And when he opened the Bible, he opened it to Psalm 127:2, which says, "In vain you rise up early and stay up late, toiling for good to eat, for God grants sleep to those God loves." Burkett said, after reading that, he was convicted solely in his heart, and he decided to limit his work week to 48 hours and found that he accomplished more than when he had worked twice as long. He adds, it occurred to me, I've never met a successful business person who came to the end of life and said, "I wish I had spent more time at work and had made just a little more money." Sometimes we participate in the evil of denial in the place where we ourselves are prisoners of a victim's mentality. Recently, I read a sermon, and the clergywoman writing was telling about leading a support group in the upper east side of New York City for women in abusive family situations. And she described a woman who was at the meeting that night talking about how her husband would repeatedly punch her in the stomach so there would be no bruises, no signs of his punching, and how he would then put a pillow over her face until she passed out. And as she described the story, she did it smiling, denying her feelings, doing her best to deny the terror and the evil of the situation. Then she went right into talking about the good times, and in her own attempt to manage or control a very out-of-control situation, She participated with evil. She betrayed herself. She practiced denial. And I just need to say today that if you are someone who finds yourself in an abusive family situation, just because we live in Johnson County and we have this wonderful place where we can worship and we drive wonderful cars and things look beautiful, we find ourselves, persons right here, find ourselves in places where we're in situations that are out of our control. I want to encourage you to contact one of our pastors or call the Congregational Care Office. The point that I'm trying to make is when we try to control the situation through denial, whether it's through an escapist mentality or a victim's mentality, we cooperate with evil. And Jesus showed us the way through evil. The way through suffering is not to deny it, but to face it. Perhaps the evil was, perhaps there were other evils in that garden we need to look at. And I suspect that one of those would be, and I'd like to suggest that one of those evils was fear. Fear in the way of procrastination. On Wednesday, NPR's Morning Edition reporter Renee Fontaine announced that Monday was the beginning of National Procrastination Week. And she offered that one of God's creations that's not guilty of procrastination are the swallows of Capistrano, who return faithfully every March 19th to nest their summers under the eaves of Mission San Juan Capistrano. On that same day, I learned about National Procrastination Week. Someone in my office handed me the wisdom from their lunchtime fortune cookie. The wisdom was, he who waits to do a great deal of good all at once will never do anything. That's a participation in evil, and it may seem small, but we put things off and we put things off, and they cause the problem to get larger and bigger. And I want to ask this morning, is procrastination the evil that distracts you? Is it the human condition that keeps you in a garden? I want to suggest that maybe you need to give it to Jesus so that it can be nailed to the cross when he goes. If you pay attention to the sermon outline, you'll notice that there's a question mark listing other behaviors, other emotions that keep us from what we should truly be doing. There's an opportunity for you to add to the list. What would you add? What distracts you? What's the human condition that keeps you in the garden? There's one last aspect of Jesus' presence in the garden I'd like for us to focus on before we close today. Jesus showed the power of prayer and the power of recognizing our human shortcomings, but I think he has also showed us that small, intimate spiritual relationships are just as sacred, just as important as the Last Supper that we celebrated last week. He took James and John and Peter and he invited them to participate with him. He knew they would fall short, but he invited them anyway. What was he trying to teach us about facing the challenges of life and the importance of community? Over the last 10 months that she has been here as our pastoral intern, the Reverend Molly Simpson, if you were here a couple of weeks ago when we celebrated Ash Wednesday, you'll recall that she was the pastor that brought the message of that hour. And I've had the privilege and honor of being her pastor, her supervising mentor pastor, over the last 10 months. This privilege has taken me to Dallas several times to meet with other mentor pastors who are supervising pastoral interns in other settings. Some 50-plus pastors have met over the course of the year to build community in a larger context and then subdivided into smaller, more intimate groupings. We came together to learn how to be better supervisors, spiritual directors, guides, pastors, listeners, better disciples. Sometimes those sessions would be charged with challenging emotion as we tried to figure out our particular problem. Sometimes as pastors, we would be present at the meetings physically, but so emotionally and spiritually worn out that we didn't shine, we didn't look our best. But we came together nonetheless. At our last meeting, a little over a week ago, we spent our time sharing what our time has meant together. How we've watched our interns grow, how we ourselves have grown, and and the ways in which we would be intentional about helping the transition, helping our congregation transition, helping our pastoral interns transition into graduated pastors, if you will. It was a blessed time, rich time. And even though there was sorrow mixed with joy, it was sacred. I remember one of the pastors saying, "For me, this has been shared grace, like having communion. When you lift up the cup of salvation, it proclaims hope and God's ever-present grace. This sharing of time with you is like sharing and proclaiming hope and grace." In my small Disciple 5 group here, that same week, one of our members offered as a devotion from Henry Nouwen's final book, Can You Drink the Cup? This said, "Nothing is sweet or easy about community. Community is a fellowship of people who do not hide their joys and sorrows, but make them visible to each other in a gesture of hope. In community, we say life is full of gains and losses, joys and sorrows, ups and downs, but we do not have to live alone. Jesus, in that 11 o'clock hour, took with him James and John and Peter, a community, a small group. He invited them to pray and to be present with him. They failed miserably, but he took them nonetheless. He took them as a gesture of hope. He took them as a way of proclaiming the good news. He took them as an offering of shared grace." If you missed the launching of the small groups that happened a couple of weeks ago, I want to encourage you to stop by the connection point to sign up for the Spiritual Academy, which will begin on March 22nd. Several of our pastors and lay leaders are offering some wonderful opportunities for growth and fellowship and community. A special prayer time will be offered before each class meeting in the Wesley Chapel on that Wednesday. I pray you will take advantage of this as well. Well, a lot has happened in this 1 hour. Jesus, in that trip to the garden with Peter, James, and John, has shown us a lot. He has shown us how to leave the control of evil and his own survival up to God. He has shown us how important it is to name the evil and to pray through the evil. He has also shown us that putting your life in God's hands may not make it okay. Sometimes it puts us in greater danger, and sometimes it subjects us to greater evil, and then other times indeed it does save us. There is no guarantee. What is guaranteed is that when we trust God, God will be with us. God will never leave us alone. He has shown us that God is with us in community and fellowship. And through suffering and through sorrow, Jesus has shown us that agony is not defeat. And essentially that the way of life, the way of the cross, leads home. As we close this morning, I want to invite you to pay attention to the song that Lance Winkler and Kenny Carter will offer us. I want you to pay attention to the words of the song. I want it to be your closing prayer. The title of the song is The Old Song, and it was written by Larry Gatlin and written at a time in his life when he finally came to realize that all of the fame and fortune, all that the world had told him is good and wonderful had reached its end. It was, and he had realized it was empty, and that finally the religion of his upbringing, the religion of his life, the God of his childhood had finally made sense, and all of this business about the cross finally came home to the place where he knew that's where the security, the way through the cross, was security and home and peace and life and freedom and liberty. Lend yourself to the words of the song and let it be your prayer.